royal retainers, and have the case against Erlan brought by a man who does not bear the title of knight. And then they will sentence Erlan to exile, with the proper time allowed for him to leave the realms of King Magnus. Or he will have to permit Erlan to be reconciled with him. And that would be the wisest solution of all. It seems to me that this case is now so clear, that whoever you present it to in Tunsberg will assist you and support you. Jon Hoftersen and his brother are there. Erland is their kinsman, just as he is the king's. The Ogmundsons will realize that injustice in this matter would be folly. You should seek out the commander of the royal retinue first. Ask him and Sir Paul Eirikson to call a meeting of the retainers who are now in town and who seem most suited to handle this case. Won't you and your kinsmen go with me, sir? Asked Simon. We don't intend to join the festivities, said Erling curtly. The Hoftersons are young. Sir Paul is old and feeble, and the others. You know yourself, sir, that they have some power, being in the king's favor and such, but what importance do they have compared to you, Erling Vidkinson? You, sir, have held more power in this country than any other chieftain since I don't know when. Behind you, sir, stand the ancient families that the people of this country have known, man after man, for as far back as the legends tell us of bad times and good times in our villages. In your father's lineage, what is Magnus Eirikson, or the sons of Haftor of Suderheim, compared to you? Is their wealth worth mentioning compared to yours? This advice you have given me. It will take time, and the Frenchmen are already in Oslo, and you can bet that they will not yield. It's clear that the king is attempting to rule Norway according to foreign customs. I know that abroad there's a tradition for the king to ignore the law when he so chooses, if he can find amenable men among the knighthood to support him. Olav Skirning has sent letters to those noblemen he could find to join him, and the bishop has promised to write as well. But you could end this dispute and unrest at once, Erling Vidkinson, by seeking out King Magnus. You are the foremost descendant of all the old noblemen here in Norway. The king knows that all the others would stand behind you. I can't say that I've noticed that in the past, said Erling bitterly. You speak with great fervor on behalf of your brother-in-law, Simon. But don't you understand that I can't do it now? If I do, people would say that I step forward the minute pressure is put on Erland and it's feared he might not be able to hold his tongue. There was silence for a moment. Then Stieg asked again, Has Erland talked? No, replied Simon impatiently. He has kept silent, and I think he'll continue to do so. Erling Vidkinson, he implored. He's your kinsman. You were friends. Erling took a few deep, heavy breaths. Yes. Simon Andersen, do you fully understand exactly what Erland Nikolausen has brought upon himself? He wanted to dissolve the royal union with the Swedes. This form of rule that has never been tested before, which seems to bring more and more hardship and difficulty to Norway for each year that passes. He wanted to go back to the old familiar rule, which we know brings good fortune and prosperity. Don't you see that this was the plan of a wise and bold man? And don't you see that now it would be difficult for anyone else to take up this plan after him? He has ruined the chances of the sons of Knut Porsche, and there are no other men of royal lineage the people can rally around. You might argue that if Erland had carried out his intentions and brought Prince Haakon here to Norway, then he would have played right into my hands. Other than deliver the boy into the country, these young fellows wouldn't have been able to do much without the intervention of sober-minded men who could handle all the rest that needed to be done. That's how it is. I can vouch for it. God knows I've reaped few rewards. Rather, I've had to set aside the care of my own estates for the 10 years I've endured unrest and toil, strife and torment without end. A few men in this country have understood as much, and I've had to be satisfied with that. He pounded his hand hard against the table. Don't you understand, Simon, that the man who took such great plans onto his shoulders, and no one knows how important they might have been to the welfare of all of us here in Norway and to our descendants for many years to come. He set them all aside, along with his breeches, on the bed of a wanton woman. God's blood. It could be he deserves to pay the same penance Alden Hestakorn did. He grew calmer. Otherwise, I have no reason to begrudge Erlund his release. And you mustn't think I'm not angry about what you have told us. I think if you follow my advice, you'll find plenty of men who will support you in this matter. But I don't think I can help you enough by joining you that I would approach the king uninvited for the sake of this cause. Simon got to his feet stiffly and arduously. His face was gray-streaked with fatigue. Stig Håkonsson came over and put his arm around his shoulders. Now he would have food. He hadn't wanted any servants in the room before they finished talking. But now he ought to regain his strength with food and drink, and then rest. Simon thanked him, but he wanted to continue on his way shortly if Stig would lend him a fresh horse, and if he would give his servant, Jan Dahl, lodging for the night. Simon had been forced to ride on ahead of his man the night before because his horse couldn't keep up with Digerbein. Yes, he had been traveling almost all night. He thought he knew the road to Manvik so well, but he had lost his way a couple of times. Stig asked him to stay until the next day. Then he would go with him at least part of the way. Well, he might even accompany him as far as Tunsberg. There's no reason for me to stay here any longer. I just want to go over to the church. Since I'm here on the estate, I want to say a prayer at Hafrid's grave, at least. The blood rushed and roared through his exhausted body. The pounding of his heart was deafening. He felt as if he might collapse. He was only half awake. But he heard his own voice saying evenly and calmly, "Won't you go over there with me, Sir Erling? Of all her kinsmen, I know she was most fond of you." He didn't look at the other man, but he could sense him stiffen. After a moment he heard through the rushing and ringing sound of his own blood the clear and courteous voice of Erling Vidkunsson. "I'll gladly do so, Simandare." "It's miserable weather," he said as he buckled on the belt with his sword and threw a thick cape around his shoulders. Simon stood as still as a rock until the other man was ready. Then they went out the door. Outside, the autumn rain was pouring down, and the fog was drifting in so thick from the sea that they could barely see more than a couple of horse lengths into the fields and the yellow leafy groves on either side of the path. It was not far to the church. Simon went to get the key from the chaplain at the parsonage nearby. He was relieved to see that new people had come since the days when he lived there, so he could avoid a long chat. It was a small stone church with only one altar. Distractedly, Simon looked at the same pictures and adornments he had seen so many hundreds of times before, as he knelt down a short distance from Erling Vidkunsson, near the white marble gravestone. He said his prayers, crossing himself at the proper times, without fully taking notice. Simon didn't understand how he'd been able to do it. But now he was in the thick of it all. What he should say, he wasn't sure, but no matter how sick with fear and shame he felt, he knew he would attempt it all the same. He remembered the white, ill face of the aging woman lying in the dim light of the bed, and her lovely, gentle voice on that afternoon when he sat at her bedside and she told him. It was a month before the child was due, and she expected that it would take her life, but she was willing and happy to pay so dearly for their son. That poor boy who now lay under the stone in a little coffin at his mother's shoulder. No man could do what he intended. But he thought of Kristen's white face. She knew what had happened when he returned from Akersnes that day. Pale and calm, she spoke of it and asked him questions. But he had looked into her eyes for one brief moment, and he didn't dare meet them again. Where she was now or what she was doing, he didn't know. whether she was at the hostel or with her husband, or whether they had persuaded her to go out to Skogheim. He had left it in the hands of Olav Skirning and Sira Ingolf. He lacked the strength to do more, and he didn't think he could waste any time. Simon didn't realize that he was hiding his face in his hands. Hofrid. It's not a question of sin or shame, my Hofrid. And yet, what she had told her husband, about her sorrow and her love, which had made her stay with that old devil. One day he had even killed the child she carried under her heart, but she stayed because she didn't want to tempt her beloved friend. Erling Vidkunsson was kneeling with no expression on his colorless, finely shaped face. He held his hands in front of his chest, with the palms pressed together. From time to time he would cross himself with a quiet, tender, and graceful gesture, and then put his fingertips together as before. No. It was too terrible for any man to do. Not even for Kristen's sake could he do that. They stood up together, bowed to the altar, and walked back through the church. Simon's spurs rang faintly with every step he took on the flagstone floor. They had still not said a word to each other since leaving the manor, and Simon had no idea what might happen next. He locked the church door, and Erling Vidkunsson walked on ahead across the cemetery. Under the little roof of the churchyard gate, he stopped. Simon joined him, and they stood there for a while before heading back out into the pouring rain. Erling spoke calmly and evenly, but Simon sensed the stifled, boundless rage that was menacing deep inside the other man. He didn't dare look up.
In the name of the devil, Simon Anderson, what do you mean by referring to that?
Simon couldn't say a word.
If you think you can threaten me so that I'll do what you want because you've heard some false rumors about events that supposedly occurred back when you were hardly weaned from your mother's breast.
His fury was snarling closer to the surface now. Simon shook his head.
I thought, sir, that if you remembered the woman who was better than the purest gold, then you might have pity for Erland's wife and children.
Sir Erling looked at him. He didn't reply, but began to scrape moss and lichen off the stones of the churchyard wall. Simon swallowed and then moistened his lips with his tongue.
I hardly know what I was thinking, Erling. Perhaps if you remembered the woman who endured all those terrible years, with no solace or help except from God alone, then you might want to help many other people, because you can, since you couldn't help her. Have you ever regretted riding away from Monvik on that day, and leaving Hofrid behind in the hands of Sir Finn? But I didn't do that.
Erling's voice was now scathing.
Because I know that she never.
But I don't think you can understand that. For if you fully understood for a single moment how proud she was, that woman who became your wife. He laughed angrily.
Then you would never have done this. I don't know how much you know, but I'll gladly tell you this. Håkon was ill at the time, and so they sent me to bring her home to her kinsmen. She and Aelin had grown up together like sisters. They were almost the same age, although Aelin was her father's sister. It so happened that whenever she came home from Manvik, we were forced to meet quite often. We would sit and talk, sometimes all night long, on the gallery to the Lindorm chamber. Every word that was spoken she and I can both defend before God on Judgment Day. Then maybe he can tell us why it had to be so. And yet God rewarded her piety in the end. He gave her a good husband as consolation for the one she had had before. Such a young whelp you were. Lying with her serving maids on her own estate. And making her raise your bastard children.
He flung far away the ball of moss he had crushed in his hand. Simon stood motionless and mute. Erling scraped off another patch of moss and tossed it aside.
I did what she asked me to do. Have you heard enough? There was no other way. Wherever else we might have met in the world, we would have had we would have had. Adultery is not a nice word. The shame of blood is much worse. Simon gave a stiff little nod. He could see that it would be laughable to say what he was thinking. Erling Vidkunsson had been in his early 20s, handsome and refined. Hallfrid had loved him so much that she would have gladly kissed his footprints in the dewy grass of the courtyard on that spring morning. Her husband was an aging, portly, loathsome farmer. What about Kristen? It would never occur to her now to think there was any danger to anyone's salvation if she lived together with her brother-in-law on the same estate for 20 years. That was something Simon had learned well enough by now. Then he said quietly, almost meekly, Hofrid didn't want the innocent child her maid had conceived with her husband to suffer in this world. She was the one who begged me to do right by her as best I could. Oh, Erling Vidkunsson, for the sake of Erland's poor wife, she's grieving herself to death. I didn't think I could leave any stone unturned while I searched for help for her and all her children. Erling stood leaning against the gatepost. His face was just as calm as always, and his voice was courteous and cool when he spoke again. I liked her, Kristin Lavran's daughter. The few times I've met her, she's a beautiful and dignified woman. And as I've told you many times now, Simon Andresen, I'm certain you'll win support if you follow my advice. But I don't fully understand what you mean by this strange notion. You can't mean that because I had to let my uncle decide my marriage, underaged as I was back then, and the maiden I loved most was already betrothed when we met, and Erland's wife is not as innocent as you say. Yes, you're married to her sister, that's true. But you are the one, not I, who has caused us to have this strange conversation. And so you'll have to tolerate that I mentioned this. I remember there was plenty of talk about it when Erland married her. It was against Lavrans Bjørgulfsson's will and advice that the marriage was arranged. But the maiden thought more of having her own way than of obeying her father or guarding her honor. Yes, she might well be a good woman all the same, but she was allowed to marry Erland, and no doubt they've had their share of joy and pleasure. I don't think Lavrans ever had much joy from that son-in-law. He had chosen another man for his daughter. When she met Erland, she was already betrothed. That much I know. He suddenly fell silent, glanced at Simon for a moment, and then turned his face away in embarrassment. Burning red with shame, Simon bowed his head, but he said in a low, firm voice, Yes, she was betrothed to me. For a moment they stood there, not daring to look at each other. Then Erling tossed away the last ball of moss, turned on his heel, and stepped out into the rain. Simon stayed where he was, but when the other man had gone some distance into the fog, he turned and signaled to him impatiently. Then they walked back, just as silently as they had come. They had almost reached the manor when Sir Erling said, I'll do it, Simon Andresen. You'll have to wait until tomorrow. Then we can travel together, all four of us. Simon looked up at the other man. His face was contorted with shame and grief. He wanted to thank him, but he couldn't. He had to bite his lip hard because his jaw was trembling so violently. As they entered the hall, Erling Vidkunsson touched Simon's shoulder as if by accident, but both of them knew that they dared not look at each other. The next day, as they were preparing for the journey, Stig Håkonsson wanted to lend Simon some clothes. He hadn't brought any with him. Simon looked down at himself. His servant had brushed and cleaned his garments, but they were still badly soiled from the long ride and the foul weather. But he gave a slap to his thighs. I'm too fat, Stig. And I won't be invited to the banquet anyway. Erling Vidkunsson stood with his foot up on the bench as his son attached his gilded spur. Erling seemed to want to keep his servants away as much as possible that day. The knight gave an oddly cross laugh. I suppose it wouldn't do any harm if it looked as if Simon Dare had spared nothing in the aid of his brother-in-law, coming right in from the road with his bold and pleasing words. He has a finely tailored tongue, this former kinsman of ours, Stig. There's only one thing I fear, that he won't know when to stop.
Simon's face was dark red, but he didn't reply.
In everything that Erling had said to him since the day before, he had noticed this scornful mocking, as well as a strangely reluctant kindness, and a firm will to see this matter through to the end, now that he had taken it on. Then they set off north from Manvik, Sir Erling, his son, and Stig, along with 10 handsomely outfitted and well-armed men. Simon, with his one servant, thought that he should have had the sense to arrive better attired and with a more impressive entourage. Simon Dara of Formo shouldn't have to ride with his former kinsman like some smallholder who had sought their support in his helpless position. But he was so weary and broken by what he had done the day before that he now felt almost indifferent to whatever outcome this journey might bring. Simon had always claimed that he put no faith in the ugly rumors about King Magnus. He was not so saintly a man that he couldn't stand some vulgar jesting among grown men, but when people put their heads together, muttering and shuddering over dark and secret sins, Simon would grow uneasy. And he thought it unseemly to listen to or believe such things about the king, when he was a member of his retinue. Yet he was surprised when he stood before the young sovereign. He hadn't seen Magnus Eiriksson since the king was a child, but he had expected there would be something womanish, weak, or unhealthy about him. But the king was one of the most handsome young men Simon had ever set eyes on, and he had a manly and regal bearing in spite of his youth and slender build. He wore a surcoat patterned in light blue and green, ankle length and voluminous, cinched around his slim waist with a gilded belt. He carried his tall, slender body with complete grace beneath the heavy garment. King Magnus had straight blonde hair framing his handsomely shaped head, although the ends of his locks had been artfully curled, so they billowed around the staunch, wide column of his neck. The features of his face were delicate and charming, his complexion fresh, with red cheeks and a faint golden tinge from the sun. He had clear eyes and an open expression. He greeted his men with a polite bearing and pleasant courtesy. Then he placed his hand on Erling Vidkinson's sleeve and led him several steps away from the others as he thanked him for coming. They talked for a moment, and Sir Erling mentioned that he had a particular request to make of the king's mercy and goodwill. Then the royal servants set a chair for the knight before the king's throne, showed the other three men to seats somewhere farther away in the hall, and left the room. Without even thinking, Simon had assumed the bearing and demeanor he had learned in his youth. He had relented and agreed to borrow from Stig a brown silk garment so that his attire was no different from what the other men wore. But he sat there feeling as if he were in a dream. He was, and yet he was not, the same man as that young Simon Dare, the alert and courtly son of a knight who had carried towels and candles for King Håkon in the Oslo castle an endless number of winters ago. He was and was not Simon, the owner of Formo, who had lived a free and merry life in the valley for all these years, largely without sorrows, although he had always known that within him resided that smoldering ember. But he turned his thoughts away from this. A stifled, ominous sense of revolt rose up inside the man. He had never willfully sinned or caused any trouble that he knew of, but fate had fanned the blaze, and he had to struggle to keep his composure while he was being roasted over a slow fire. He rose to his feet along with all the others. King Magnus had stood up. "Dear kinsmen," he said in his young, fresh voice, "here is how I view this matter. The prince is my brother, but we have never attempted to share a royal retinue. The same men cannot serve us both. Nor does it sound as if this was Erlan's intention. Although for a while he might continue as sheriff under my rule, even after becoming one of Hawken's retainers. But those of my men who would rather join my brother Hawken will be released from my service and be permitted to try their fortune at his court. Who they might be, that's what I intend to find out from Erlan's lips.
Then, my lord king, said Erling, you must try to reach agreement with Erlan Nikolausen regarding this matter. You must keep the promise of safe conduct which you have made, and grant your kinsman an interview.
Yes, he is my kinsman and yours, and Sir Ivar persuaded me to promise him safe conduct. But he did not keep his promise to me, nor did he remember our kinship.
King Magnus gave a small laugh, and then placed his hand on Erling's arm once more.
Dear friend, my kinsmen seem to live by the saying we have here in Norway, that a kinsman is the worst enemy of his kin. I am quite willing to show mercy to my kinsman, Erland of Huseby, for the sake of God and Our Lady and my betrothed. I will grant him his life and property and lift the sentence of banishment if he will be reconciled with me. Or I will allow him proper time to leave my kingdoms if he wishes to join his new lord, Prince Hakon. This same mercy I will show to any man who has conspired with him. But I want to know which of my men residing in this country have served their lord falsely. What have you to say, Simon Andersen? I know that your father was my grandfather's faithful supporter, and that you yourself served King Hakon with honor. Do you think I have the right to investigate this matter?
I think, my lord king, Simon stepped forward and bowed again, that as long as your grace rules in accordance with the laws and customs of the land, with benevolence, then you will never find out who these men might be who tried to resort to lawlessness and treason. For as soon as the people see that your grace intends to uphold the laws and traditions established by your ancestors, then surely no man in this kingdom would think of breaking the peace. Instead, they will hold their tongues and acknowledge what for a time it may have been difficult to believe, that you, my lord, in spite of your youth, can rule two kingdoms with wisdom and power.
That is so, your majesty, added Erling Vidkunsson. No man in this country would think of refusing you allegiance over something which you lawfully command.
No?
Then you think that Erland may not have incited betrayal and high treason, if we look closer at the case?
For a moment Sir Erling seemed at a loss for a reply when Simon spoke.
You, my lord, are our king, and every man expects that you will counter lawlessness with law. But if you pursue the path that Erlan Nikolausen has embarked upon, then men might step forward to state their names, which you are now pressing so hard to discover, or other men might begin to wonder about the true nature of this case, for it will be much discussed if your grace proceeds as you have warned, against a man as well-known and high-born as Erlan Nikolausen.
What do you mean by that, Simon Andersen? Said the king sharply, and his face turned crimson.
Simon means, interjected Bjarne Erlingsen, that your grace might be poorly served if people began to ask why Erland was not allowed the privilege of personal security, which is the right of every man except thieves and villains. They might even begin to think about King Hakon's other grandsons.
Erling Vidkunsson swiftly turned to face his son with a furious expression. But the king asked dryly,
Don't you consider traitors to be villains?
No one will call him that if he wins support for his plans, replied Bjarne. For a moment they all fell silent. Then Erling Vidkunsson said,
Whatever Erland is called, my lord, it would not be proper for you to disregard the law for his sake.
Then the law needs to be changed in this case, said the king vehemently, if it is true that I have no power to obtain information about how the people intend to show their loyalty to me.
And yet you cannot proceed with a change in the law before it has been enacted without exerting excessive force against the people. and from ancient times the people have had difficulty in accepting excessive force from their kings, said Sir Erling stubbornly.
I have my knights and my royal retainers to support me, replied Magnus Eiriksson with a boyish laugh. What do you say to this, Simon?
I think, my lord, it may turn out that this support cannot be counted on. Judging by the way the knights and nobles in Denmark and Sweden have dealt with their kings when the people had no power to support the crown against the nobles. But if your grace is considering such a plan, then I would ask you to release me from your service. For then, I would rather take my place among the peasants.
Simon spoke in such a calm and composed manner that the king at first seemed not to understand what he had said. Then he laughed.
Are you threatening me, Simon Anderson? Do you want to cast down your gauntlet before me?
As you wish, my lord, said Simon just as calmly as before, but he took his gloves from his belt and held them in his hand. Then the young Bjarne leaned over and took them.
These are not proper wedding gloves for your grace to buy.
He held up the thick, worn riding gloves and laughed.
If word gets out, my lord, that you have demanded such gloves, you might receive far too many of them, and for a good price.
Erling Vidkunsson gave a shout. With an abrupt movement, he seemed to sweep the young king to one side and the three men to the other. He urged them toward the door.
I must speak to the king alone.
No, no, I want to talk to Bjarne, called the king, running after them.
But Sir Erling shoved his son outside along with the others. For some time they roamed around the castle courtyard and out on the slope. No one said a word. Stig Håkansson looked pensive but held his tongue, as he had all along. Bjarne Erlingsson walked around with a little secretive smile on his lips the whole time. After a while, Sir Erling's arms-bearer came out and said that his master requested they wait for him at the hostel. Their horses stood ready in the courtyard. And so they waited at the hostel. They avoided discussing what had happened. Finally, they fell to talking about their horses and dogs and falcons. By late that evening, Stig and Simon ended up recounting amorous adventures. Stig Håkansson had always had a good supply of such tales, but Simon discovered that whenever he began to tell some remembered story, Stig would take over, saying that either the event had happened to him, or it had recently occurred somewhere near Manvik. Even though Simon recalled hearing the tale in his childhood, told by servants back home at Diefrin. But he laughed and roared along with Stig. Once in a while he felt as if the bench were swaying under him. He was afraid of something but didn't dare think about what it might be. Bjarne Erlingsson laughed quietly as he drank wine, gnawed on apples, and fidgeted with his hood. Now and then he would tell some little anecdote, and they were always the worst of the lot, but so wily that Stig could not understand them. Bjarne said that he had heard them from the priest at Björgvin. Finally, Sir Erling arrived. His son went to meet him, to take his outer garments. Erling turned angrily to the youth.
You!
He threw his cape into Bjarne's arms. Then a trace of a smile, which he refused to acknowledge, flitted across the father's face. He turned to Simon and said,
Well, now you must be content, Simon Anderson. You can rest assured that the day is not far off when you will be sitting together in peace and comfort on your neighboring estates, you and Erland, along with his wife and all their sons.
Simon's face had turned a shade more pale as he stood up to thank Sir Erling. He realized what the fear was that he hadn't dared face. But now there was nothing to be done about it. About 14 days later, Erland Nikolausen was released. Simon, along with two men and Ulf Haldorsson, rode out to Åkersnes to bring him home. The trees were already nearly bare, for there had been a strong wind the week before. Frost had set in. The earth rang hard beneath the horses' hooves, and the fields were pale with rime as the men rode in toward town. It looked like snow, The sky was overcast, and the daylight was dreary and a chilly gray. Simon noticed that Erlan dragged one leg a bit as he came out to the castle courtyard, and his body seemed stiff and clumsy as he mounted his horse. He was also very pale. He had shaved off the beard, and his hair was trimmed and neat. The upper part of his face was now a sallow color, while the lower part was white with bluish stubble. There were deep hollows under his eyes. But he was a handsome figure in the long, dark blue surcoat and cap, and as he bade farewell to Olav Skirning and handed out gifts of money to the men who had guarded him and brought him food in prison, he looked like a chieftain who was parting with the servants at a wedding feast. As they rode off, he seemed at first to be freezing. He shivered several times. Then a little color crept into his cheeks, and his face brightened, as if sap and vitality were welling up inside him. Simon thought it was no easier to break Erlan than a willow branch. They reached the hostel, and Kristen came out to meet her husband in the courtyard. Simon tried to avert his eyes, but he could not. They took each other's hands and exchanged a few words, their voices quiet and clear. They handled this meeting under the eyes of the servants in a manner that was graceful and seemly enough. Except that they flushed bright red as they gazed at each other for a moment, and then they both lowered their eyes. Erland once again offered his wife his hand, and together they walked toward the loft room, where they would stay while they were in Oslo. Simon turned toward the room which he and Kristen had shared up until now. Then she turned around on the lowest step to the loft room and called to him with a strange resonance in her voice.
"Aren't you coming, brother-in-law? Have some food first, and you too, Ulf."
Her body seemed so young and soft as she stood there with her hip turned slightly, looking back over her shoulder. As soon as she arrived in Oslo, she had begun fastening her wimple in a different manner than before. Here in the south, only the wives of smallholders wore the wimple in the old-fashioned way she had worn it ever since she was married, tightly framing her face like a nun's wimple, with the ends crossed in front, so her neck was completely hidden, and the folds draped along the sides and over her hair, which was knotted at the nape of her neck. In Trøndelag, it was considered a sign of piety to wear the wimple in this manner, which Archbishop Eiliv had always praised as the most seemly and chaste style for married women. But in order to fit in, Kristen had adopted the fashion of the south, with the linen cloth placed smoothly on her head and hanging straight back, so that her hair in front was visible, and her neck and shoulders were free. And another part of the style was to have the braids simply pinned up so they couldn't be seen under the edge of the wimple, with the cloth fitted softly to the shape of her head. Simon had seen this before and thought it suited her, but he had never noticed how young it made her look, and her eyes were shining like stars. Later in the day, a great many people arrived to bring greetings to Erlan: Ketil of Skog, Markus Torgerson, and later that evening Olav Skirning himself, along with Sira Ingolf and Herr Guttum, a priest from St. Halvard's Church. By the time the two priests arrived, it had begun to snow, a fine, dry powder, and they had lost their way in a field and wandered into some burdock bushes. Their clothing was full of burrs. Everyone busily fell to picking the burdocks from the priests and their servants. Erland and Kristen were helping Herr Guttorm. Every now and then they would blush as they jested with the priest, their voices strangely unsteady and quavering when they laughed. Simon drank a good deal early in the evening, but it didn't make him merry, only a little more sluggish. He heard every word that was said, his hearing unbearably sharp. The others soon began speaking openly. None of them supported the king. After a while, he felt so strangely weary of it all. They sat there spouting foolish chatter, in loud and heated voices. Ketil Osmundsson was quite a simpleton, and his brother-in-law Markus was not much more clever himself. Olav Skirning was a right-minded and sensible man, but short-sighted. And to Simon, the two priests didn't seem any more intelligent. Now they were all sitting there listening to Erland and agreeing with him. and he grew more and more like the man he had always been, brash and impetuous. Now he had taken Kristen's hand and placed it on his knee. He was sitting there playing with her fingers, and they sat close together, so their shoulders touched. Now she blushed bright red. She couldn't take her eyes off him. When he put his arm around her waist, her lips trembled, and she had trouble pressing them closed. Then the door flew open, and Munan Bardson stepped in. "At last, the mighty ox himself arrives," shouted Erlan, jumping up and going to greet him. "May God and the Virgin Mary help us. I don't think you're troubled in the least, Erlan," said Munan, annoyed. "And do you think it would do any good to whine and weep now, kinsman? I've never seen anything like it. You've squandered all your wealth." "Well, I was never the kind of man who would go to hell with a bare backside merely to save my breeches from being burned," said Erlan, and Kristen laughed softly, looking flustered. Simon leaned over the table and rested his head on his arms. If only they would think he was so drunk that he'd fallen asleep. He just wanted to be left alone. Nothing was any different than he'd expected, or at least ought to have expected. She wasn't either. Here she sat, the only woman among all these men, as gentle and modest, comfortable and confident as ever. That's how she had been back then, when she betrayed him. Shameless or innocent, he wasn't sure. Oh no, that wasn't true either. She hadn't been confident at all. She hadn't been shameless. She hadn't been calm behind that calm demeanor. But the man had bewitched her. For Erlan's sake, she would gladly walk on searing stones, and she had trampled on Simon as if she thought he was nothing more than a cold stone. And here he lay, thinking foolishness. She had wanted to have her way and thought of nothing else. Let them have their joy. It made no difference to him. He didn't care if they produced 7 more sons. Then there would be 14 to divide up the inheritance from Lavrans Bjørgulfsson's estate. It didn't look as if he would have to worry about his own children. Romborg wasn't as quick to give birth as her sister. And one day his descendants would be left with power and wealth after his death. But it made no difference to him. Not this evening. He wanted to keep on drinking, but he knew that tonight God's gifts would have no hold on him, and then he would have to lift his head and perhaps be pulled into the conversation. "Well, you probably think you would have made a good regent, don't you?" said Munan scornfully. "No, you should know that we intended that position for you," laughed Erlan. "In God's name, watch your tongue, man." The others laughed. Erlan came over and touched Simon's shoulder. "Are you sleeping, brother-in-law?" Simon looked up. Erlan was standing before him with a goblet in his hand. "Drink with me, Simon. To you I owe the most gratitude for saving my life, which is dear to me, even such as it is, my man. You stood by me like a brother. If you hadn't been my brother-in-law, I would have surely lost my head. Then you could have had my widow." Simon leaped to his feet. For a moment they stood there staring at each other. Erlan grew sober and pale. His lips parted in a gasp. Simon knocked the goblet out of the other man's hand with his fist. The mead spilled out. Then he turned on his heel and left the room. Erlan stayed where he was. He wiped his hand and wrist on the fabric of his surcoat without realizing that he was doing so, then looked around. The others hadn't noticed. With his foot, he pushed the goblet under the bench, then stood there a moment before following after his brother-in-law. Simon Dare was standing at the bottom of the stairs. Jon Dahlk was leading his horses from the stable. He didn't move when Erlan came down to stand beside him.
"Simon. Simon, I didn't know. I didn't know what I was saying."
"Now you do." Simon's voice was toneless. He stood stock still, without looking at the other man. Erlan glanced around him helplessly. A pale sliver of the moon shone through the veil of clouds. Small, hard bits of snow were falling. Erlan shivered in the cold.
Where are you going?
He asked uncertainly, looking at the servant and horses.
To find myself another inn, said Simon curtly. You know full well that I can't stay here.
Simon,
Erlan exclaimed. Oh, I don't know what I would give to have those words unsaid.
As would I, replied the other man in the same voice.
The door to the loft opened. Kristen stepped out onto the gallery with a lantern in her hand. She leaned over and shone the light on them.
Is that where you are?
She asked in her clear voice.
What are you doing outdoors?
I thought I should see to my horses, as it's the custom for polite people to say, replied Simon, laughing up at her.
But you've taken your horses out, she said merrily.
Yes, a man can do strange things when he's been drinking, said Simon in the same manner as before.
Well, come back up here now,
she called, her voice bright and joyful.
Yes, at once.
She went inside, and Simon shouted to Jan to put the horses back in the stable. Then he turned to Erlan, who was standing there, his expression and demeanor oddly numb.
I'll come inside in a few minutes. We must try to pretend it was never said, Erlan, for the sake of our wives. But this much you might realize, that you were the last man on earth I wanted to know about this. And don't forget that I'm not as forgetful as you are.
The door above them opened again. The guests came swarming out, and Kristen was with them. Her maid carried the lantern.
Well, it's getting late, teased Munan Bardson. And I think these two must be longing for bed.
Erlan, Erlan, Erlan.
Kristen had flung herself into his arms as soon as they were alone inside the loft. She clung tightly to him.
Erlan, you look sad,
she whispered fearfully, with her half-parted lips against his mouth.
Erlan?
She pressed both of her hands to his temples. He stood there for a moment with his arms limply clasped around her. Then, with a soft moaning sound in his throat, he crushed her to him. Simon walked over to the stable. He was going to tell Jan something, but halfway there he forgot what it was. For a moment he stood in front of the stable door and looked up at the hazy moonlight and the snow drifting down. Now bigger flakes were beginning to fall. Jan and Ulf came out and closed the door behind them, and then the three men walked together over to the building where they would sleep. 3. The Cross. Part 1. Honor Among Kin. Chapter 1. During the second year that Erlan Nikolausen and Kristin Lavran's daughter lived at Urengard, Kristin decided to spend the summer up in the mountain pastures. She had been thinking about this ever since winter. At Shenna, it had long been the custom for the mistress herself to stay in the mountain pastures. In the past, a daughter from the manor had once been lured into the hills, and afterward her mother insisted on living in the mountains each summer. But in many ways, they had their own customs at Shenna. People in the region were used to it and expected as much. But elsewhere, it wasn't customary for the women of the gentry on the large estates to go up to the pastures. Kristin knew that if she did so, people would be surprised and would gossip about it. In God's name, then, let them talk. No doubt they were already talking about her and her family. Auden Torbershen owned nothing more than his weapons and the clothes on his back when he was wed to Ingebjörg Nikolaus' daughter of Lopsgaard. He had been a groom for the Bishop of Hamar. It was back when the bishop came north to consecrate the new church that Ingebjörg suffered the misfortune. Nikolaus Sigurdsson took it hard at first, swearing by God and man that a stable boy would never be his son-in-law. But Ingebjörg gave birth to twins, and people said with a laugh that Nikolaus evidently thought it would be too much to support them on his own. he allowed his daughter to marry Audun. This happened 2 years after Kristen's wedding. It had not been forgotten, and people probably still thought of Audun as a stranger to the region. He was from Hadland, of good family, but his lineage had become quite impoverished, and the man himself was not well-liked in Seal. He was obstinate, hard-headed, and slow to forget either bad or good. But he was a most enterprising farmer, with a fair knowledge of the law. In many ways, Audun Torbjörnsson was now a respected man in the parish, and a man with whom people were loath to become foes. Kristen thought about Audun's broad, tanned face, with the thick, curly red hair and beard, and those sharp, small blue eyes of his. He looked like many other men she had seen. She had seen such faces among their servants at Husaby, among Erland's men and ship's crew. She sighed. It must be easier for such a man to assert himself as he sat there on his wife's ancestral state, since he had never ruled over anything else. All winter and spring, Kristen spent time talking to Frida Styrker's daughter, who had come with them from Trøndelag and was in charge of all her other maids. Again and again she would tell the woman about such and such was the way they did things here in the valley during the summer. This was what the haymakers were used to getting, and this was how things were done at harvest time. Surely Frida must remember how Kristen had done things the year before, for she wanted everything on the manor to be just as it was during Ronfrid Ivarsdottir's time. But to come right out and say that she would not be there on the farm during the summer, that was hard for her to do. She had been the mistress of Jørundgard for 2 winters and a summer, and she knew that if she went up to the mountain pastures now, it would be the same as running away. She realized that Erland was in a terribly difficult position. Ever since the days when he sat on his foster mother's knee, he had never known anything other than that he was born to command and rule over everything and everyone around him. And if the man had allowed himself to be ruled and commanded by others, at least he had never been aware of this himself. He couldn't possibly feel the way he outwardly seemed. He must be unhappy here. She herself, her father's estate at the bottom of the quiet closed-in valley, the flat fields along the curve of the gleaming river through the alder woods, the farms on the cultivated land far below at the foot of the mountain, and the steep slopes above, with the gray clefts against the sky overhead, pale slides of scree and the spruce forest and leafy woods clambering upward through the meadows from the valley. No, this no longer seemed to her the most beautiful and safest home in the world. It felt closed off. Surely Erland must think that it was ugly and confining and unpleasant. But no one could tell anything from his appearance, except that he seemed content. On the day when they let out the livestock at Jørundgard, she finally managed to speak of it, in the evening as they ate their supper. Erland was picking through the fish platter in search of a good piece. In surprise, he sat there with his fingers in the dish while he stared at his wife. Then Kristen added quickly that it was mostly because of the throat ailment that was rampant among the children in the valley. Munan wasn't strong. She wanted to take him and Lavrans along with her up to the mountains. "Well," said Erland, "in that case it would be advisable for Ivar and Skúla to go with her too." The twins leaped up from the bench. During the rest of the meal they both chattered at once. They wanted to go with Erling, who would be camping north among the gray peaks with the sheep. 3 years before, the sheepherders from Seal had caught a poacher and killed him near his stone hut in the Boar Range. He was a man who had been banished to the forest from Ørsterdal. As soon as the servants got up from the table, Ivar and Skúla brought into the hall all the weapons they owned and sat down to tinker with them. A little later that evening, Kristen set off southward with Simon Andersen's daughters and her own sons, Gauta and Lavrans. Arnjord Simon's daughter had been at Jørundgard most of the winter. The maiden was now 15 years old, and one day during Christmas at Formo, Simon had mentioned that Arnjord ought to learn something more than what they could teach her at home. She was just as skilled as the serving maids. Kristen had then offered to take the girl home with her and teach her as best she could. for she could see that Simon dearly loved his daughter and worried a great deal about her future. And the child needed to learn other ways than those practiced at Formo. Since the death of his wife's parents, Simon Andresen was now one of the richest men in the region. He managed his properties with care and good sense, and he oversaw the farm work at Formo with zeal and intelligence. But indoors, things were handled poorly. The serving women were in charge of everything. Whenever Simon noticed that the disarray and slovenliness in the house had surpassed all bounds, he would hire one or two more maids, but he never spoke of such things to his wife, and seemed neither to wish nor to expect that she should pay more attention to the housekeeping. It was almost as if he didn't yet consider her to be fully grown up, but he was exceedingly kind and amenable toward Romborg, and was constantly showering her and the children with gifts. Kristen grew fond of Arnjord after she got to know her. The maiden was not pretty, but she was clever, gentle, good-hearted, nimble-fingered, and diligent. When the young girl accompanied her around the house or sat by her side in the weaving room in the evenings, Kristen often thought that she wished one of her own children had been a daughter. A daughter would spend more time with her mother. She was thinking about that on this evening as she led Lavrans by the hand and looked at the two children, Gauta and Arnjord, who were walking ahead of her along the road. Ulvild was running about, stomping through the brittle layer of nighttime ice on the puddles of water. She was pretending to be some kind of animal and had turned her red cloak around so that the white rabbit fur was on the outside. Down in the valley in the dusk, the shadows were deepening across the bare brown fields, but the air of the spring evening seemed sated with light. The first stars were sparkling, wet and white, high up in the sky, where the limpid green was turning blue, moving toward darkness and night. Above the black rim of the mountains on the other side of the valley, a border of yellow light still lingered, and its glow lit up the scree covering the steep slope that towered above them as they walked. At the very top, where the snowdrifts jutted out over the ridges, the snow glistened, and underneath glittered the glaciers, which gave birth to the streams rushing and splashing everywhere down through the scree. The sound of water completely filled the air of the countryside. From below reverberated the loud roar of the river, and the singing of birds came from the groves and leafy shrubbery on all sides. Once Ulvild stopped, picked up a stone, and threw it toward the sound of the birds. Her big sister grabbed her arm, and she walked on calmly for a while. But then she tore herself away and ran down the hill until Gauta shouted after her. They had reached the place where the road headed into the forest. From the thickets came the ringing of a steel bow. Inside the woods, snow lay on the ground, and the air smelled cold and fresh. A little farther on, in a small clearing, stood Erland with Ivar and Skule. Ivar had taken a shot at a squirrel. The arrow was stuck high up in the trunk of a fir tree, and now he was trying to get it down. He pitched stone after stone at it. The huge mast tree resonated when he struck the trunk.
"Wait a minute. I'll try to see if I can shoot it down for you," said his father.
He shook his cape back over his shoulders, placed an arrow in his bow, and took aim rather carelessly in the uncertain light among the trees. The string twanged. The arrow whistled through the air and buried itself in the tree trunk, right next to the boys. Erland took out another arrow and shot again. One of the two arrows sticking out of the tree clattered down from branch to branch. The shaft of the other one had splintered, but the point was still embedded in the tree. Skule ran into the snow to pick up the two arrows. Ivar stood and stared up at the treetop.
"It's mine! The one that's still up there, father! It's buried up to the shaft. That was a powerful shot, father."
Then he proceeded to explain to Gauta why he hadn't hit the squirrel. Erland laughed softly and straightened his cape.
"Are you going to turn back now, Kristen? I'm setting off for home. We're planning to go after wood grouse early in the morning, Nokva and I."
Kristen told him briskly no, that she wanted to accompany the maidens to their manor. She wanted to have a few words with her sister tonight. Then Ivar and Skula can go with Mother and escort her home if I can stay with you, Father, said Gauta.
Erland lifted Ulvild Simon's daughter up in his arms in farewell. Because she was so pretty and pink and fresh,